I am a podcast, nothing more. Nosferatu. It's coming up next.
Haven't Seen It with Tim Sestito and Tommy Tevenay. Hello, everybody. Welcome on in. Thank you all so much for listening today. This is a podcast where one of us is watching a movie for the very first time. And today, that is, I think, myself for one of the... We're covering both Nosferatus. Two of the three Nosferatus. We're excluding the 1979 version, but we are covering the one that was just released by Robert Eggers, and then the original silent German film from 1922. Tommy, you had seen the silent feature before, yes?
Yeah, I've seen the silent one about like 3 years ago. So
SpongeBob doesn't count, by the way.
No, not at all. So yeah, I've seen the original like 3 years ago. Just a weird piece of history.
Yeah, it's very interesting coming off, because I had seen I went and saw Nosferatu in theaters a couple of weeks ago, like the new one. And then when I was watching The Silent to prepare for this episode, everything from that movie just came back to me because of how similarly structured the stories are, even though they tell it in very different ways, obviously. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely an important film. I was just looking up what the average feature film length in 1922 was, and it was 15 minutes. And this movie is 90 minutes. So to tell you how this is different from what audiences would expect at the time, these longer movies didn't really have their footing yet. And
we'll get into it later, but like it's just interesting that like how this movie survived when so many silent movies are just lost media right now. Like Scorsese says that apparently like roughly 90% of films made before 1929 are just lost. Like the film prints are either destroyed or just none surviving copies. So the fact that Nosferatu in 1922 has survived all these years later is just amazing, especially the journey to get there, where like we shouldn't be seeing this. It should have been destroyed. So
yeah, and it's a big part of that was the film was the night had the nitrate on the film, so it was very easy to burn, and especially at the time when people were just smoking cigarettes left, right, and center. You know, you're handling this film with a cigarette in your mouth, like, yeah, it's gonna burn up. And they just also didn't put any importance on film preservation at that time, because it was probably just seen as like, this will be in a movie theater for X months, and then we don't like we just like what do we do with these film reels?
Exactly. It's just like, do we even care about this? Do we even need to worry about this?
Yeah.
So it's insane to think about it, because like apparently, like, you know, this movie, like the way they film changed the film characters to not be exactly like a copyright ripoff of Dracula, because this is the unauthorized version of Dracula. And then Bram Stoker's widow found out about it and was like, you just pretty much copied my husband's work with
novel.
Dracula.
Yeah.
And they ordered like essentially like you know, in court, they end up ordering every single film print of Nosferatu to be destroyed. And somehow, through the luck of just like film preservationists, some copies and some prints rather survived. And now we're ended up being like over 100 years later, we're still able to talk about this movie. And Nosferatu is such a big popular culture in a whole different way from Dracula himself.
Yeah, and we covered Dracula on the podcast. You can go back and listen to that episode if you'd like. It was October of last year. Like, I could see the similarities. It's very striking. I've never read the Bram Stoker's novel, but there's definitely differences in the film adaptation of the story of Dracula versus the novel. And I wonder if a part of that had to do with trying to distinguish itself from Nosferatu.
Yeah, I'm curious to see in like in the overall historical, like how well known was Nosferatu like by that point, when the time we got to 1931 in Dracula, like was that really known that well, or is that more of like a cult film that somehow just broke out and lasted through just legacy and everything.
I mean, I think it's one of those things that these kind of films that if you're in the film world, you're probably interested in trying to find it and trying to watch it and like procure it down. But you also see some very early, cinematic language in the silent film itself. But we will talk about all of that. That's what this whole episode is going to be about. Kind of compare and contrast the Robert Eggers version and the original. But Tommy, what, give me a movie. What's a movie you saw recently?
Yeah, so 2 weeks ago, I went to go see a screening of American Psycho, a movie I have not
Ooh.
seen in over a decade, and it was very cool. Shout out to Sign Studio in Hartford. They had a screening with the director, which I don't have her name pulled up right
It's
here.
Mary. What, Mary, what's her name? I know.
Mary Harron. Mary Harron. And it was just an awesome screening. I mean, that movie I haven't seen forever, like I said. And just like everything from Christian Bale to the whole like comedy that I didn't realize was there when I first watched this movie, like kind of half watched it 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It's just such a great satire of like the 80s cultural life. And Mary Harron was giving off great comments about like how like she treated Willem Dafoe on set, how she got like different things in terms of like production values of like how there's specific art pieces that were hanging in Patrick Bateman's house that like showed how like shallow he was about the art world and how that came to be on top of like, you know, the Huey Lewis thing and everything like that.
Yeah.
So
How was
but
the Q&A part of it?
it was fine. I mean, you know, Q&A is essentially like thankfully we didn't have the typical what do you suggest for like a new filmmaker question, which I feel
Yeah,
like you always get.
I didn't get that, but I saw I when I went to I saw a Q&A with Taika Waititi when he did Jojo Rabbit, and it was weird because I remember the advertisement for it popped up like 2 days before the event, so it was clearly like it was scheduled, but everybody forgot about it, and then they forced him to do it before the movie. So you just had a theater full of people, some who had seen the movie, some who hadn't, and he handled a Q&A beforehand. And I just remember one woman being like, "Oh, Mr. Watiti, like I want to show this film to my son. I want them to understand, prejudices and biases. And what do you think I should say to them when they're watching this film?" And he's like, "I don't know. I don't know your kid. Like, you know your kid." Like, I was like, "Oh man," it made me go, "I don't really need to go to Q&As, do I? Huh? It's just really just people asking, like, it's never like something technical. It's never something interesting. It's always something odd and kind of stupid."
I mean, there's certain people I feel like are fun for Q and A's. Like I've seen Kevin Smith do two Q and A's, but he's a great Q and A'er because he will literally answer one question and then just ramble. And Kevin Smith rambling, he's such a great rambler where he just like is such a great auteur where he
And
just
I feel
talks and
like
talks and talks.
I know I've talked shit about Kevin Smith films on this podcast, but I do get a genuine sense that he's like a really down to earth guy and like a cool person to actually like converse with and like actually appreciates the people that enjoy his film and enjoy his work and like wants to like be a part of that ecosystem with them. So like which I respect him for a lot.
Where it's almost like a stand-up show in a way too, of like him just like going off and telling jokes, whereas like some of them you see are like, oh God, this just drags and drags. Mary Harron was not like that. She was a great Q&A-er. I mean, I don't think she got any amazing questions, but I do like the fact. I mean, this is a famous fact about this movie. When you watch American Psycho, the way she filmed Willem Dafoe plays basically a private detective who's out to investigate
The murders.
what the murders have been happening. And he basically, the way she filmed the movie with Willem Dafoe was every time he's talking to Christian Bale, she made him do three takes. One was where Willem Dafoe knows he did it. The second one was where he thinks he did it, but he's not sure. And the third one is, he
He
doesn't know it
did.
all.
He doesn't know it all.
So, and she cut those three things between every single different shot of Willem Dafoe in the movie. So it creates a sense of paranoia where you're in Patrick Bateman's head, where you don't know what the hell is going on. Does this guy know what I did? What am I crashing out? Am I okay? Am I in the clear? You just don't know what's going on. And just what a way to like a piece of film editing and performance editing to just make a movie incredible.
Just to give it like that kind of legacy, because American Psycho definitely has a lasting legacy with it. Whether it's people misinterpreting the character Patrick Bateman or not, it certainly does have a legacy. I went and saw a rather long film, Tommy. I saw The Brutalist.
Ooh, 3 hours and like what, 30 minutes?
There's an intermission in there. I will say to its credit, it's very well paced. While the subject matter is really bloated, I would say, like it's trying to. By the time the second act comes around, like after the intermission break, it starts trying to put more ideals of like Zionism, Israel, Palestine. Like it starts mentioning all these little things. Like it handles drug addiction and like, you know, differences in cultures and how we can actually get along. It's one of those things where the movie's really good. It's definitely worth a watch. If you enjoy great character studies, Adrien Brody's Laszlo is fantastic. Felicity Jones also, like, just great performances. Guy Pearce is so much fun in this movie. He's the wealthy businessman that gives Laszlo a shot at building this community center. And I've been wrestling with it because it's very deep. I understand its messages. It just didn't have that effect that it's had to some people where they're like, this is one of the greatest movies ever made. I didn't necessarily feel it that way. I kind of felt more of like, it's a really good movie. It's definitely worth watching. It's definitely worth being discussed. I just didn't see it as like the greatest film, one of the greatest films ever made. But I mean, it's beautifully shot, like really fantastic cinematography. The lighting is so good. I was
You
watching a
say it was
video.
well paced. I mean, given the fact that it's like
Yeah, oh,
what?
it does not feel its runtime at all. I was not looking at my clock at all. Like it went to the intermission and I was like, wait, we're at the intermission already?
Yeah. That's
But
hilarious. 'Cause yeah, that's
and because it was so full of ideas, this movie, I was very surprised that it was as well paced as it was. It really doesn't dawdle too much, which sometimes those longer movies can linger and smell their own fart. I mean, I'm as big a Scorsese guy as they can come. I just remember my big issue with The Irishman was there was just moments like long stretches where I was like, we can trim some of this out, okay? Like it's not
Yeah.
really adding tension. It's just creating a longer pace, Marty.
I mean, it did help that we saw that movie in theaters. Whereas a lot of people saw a movie on Netflix where they can pause it and like take a break or something like that. Or basically, I think I went to the bathroom maybe like 5 times or something like that throughout the movie. Maybe a little
Five
less.
times.
Maybe
Jeez,
like
get your bladder checked out.
it might have been three to five. This is 5 years ago. This is a lot to remember. How many of the movies have you seen nominated for Best Picture so far?
Not a ton, to be
Yeah.
honest.
I'm getting there. We signed up. I didn't tell you this, but we signed up for like a ballot thing for the Oscars for like other indie podcasters, and the deadline is Friday. And I realized that I've only seen Emilia Perez, Conclave,
What were your thoughts
and
on
The Substance.
quick thoughts on Emilia Perez?
Fucking worst piece of shit I've seen all year.
Really, really,
Hated
it's
it.
that bad.
Hated everything about it. The songs are not memorable whatsoever. I mean, like the way they basically like portray the trans people is just like borderline offensive. I'm sure you saw like a clip going around on Twitter
The
of like the penis or vagina.
penis and
Penis and vagina.
vagina.
Yeah, it's just like laughably bad. And like it'll be one thing that the movie was going for like a camp factor, but it just did not sustain that tone. I just felt like I was constantly checking my fucking like watch or runtime. It's like, how much time is over? How much fucking time is over? Over and over and over again. It was a movie that was like not even that long. I mean, The Brutalist is definitely longer than Emilia Perez, but I felt like it was just excruciating pace-wise and just never want to watch it again. I'm baffled that this movie is nominated for Oscars. I mean,
Getting 13 nominations, insane.
yeah. But I think the Oscar race is completely tanked because Carla Sofia Gascón, all those racist tweets of hers resurfaced, where it's like really bad, where it's like, holy shit.
She had a Kanye West run up there, huh? On Twitter.
Yeah. And everyone's
Not
just like, yeah, this is not good.
great,
So.
not great, but let's continue on with our discussion and let's go into Nosferatu.
Come to me. He is coming.
is coming.
He is coming to us.
He's coming.
Who is coming to you, my child?
Nosferatu.
Rated R, only in theaters Christmas Day. Special engagements in Dolby and IMAX.
So yeah, they didn't really have a TV spot for the 1922 silent film. I'm sure you're all very stunned by that.
Yeah, only
revelation.
30 years before the modern invention of TV.
Yeah, and 50 years before they even came up with TV spots. Believe me, I know, because having to find TV spots for some of our older movies, a lot of times I just find like airing on TC Turner Classic Movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Is X. Coming up next. Yeah, we're covering both of them. We both most recently have watched the silent film, but I think they kind of go hand in hand because the Robert Eggers one is, as I was saying before, a very literal translation. I think the only real change that I could see was the kind of like the beginning and the connection that Count Orloff had with the wife, like, and like how he was in his life. Like, I felt like that part was a little more expanded upon in the Robert Eggers movie, but everything else was pretty like by the numbers, you know?
Yeah. I mean, granted, obviously, like, you know, pacing wise is a little bit different. Obviously, the fact that you can speak in it is a lot different, but like overall, same plot. The design of Nosferatu is a little different in this, and first of all, let's get on that. What do you think about the design of Nosferatu in the 2024 version?
I loved it. I thought he was...
It fucking rocked. The mustache and everything.
Alexander Skarsgård has just made a career off of not showing his face. And just
you mean Bill Skarsgård?
Bill Skarsgård. There's so many Skarsgårds, okay?
Yeah, it's like hard to keep track.
There's four Skarsgårds, okay? I get them confused, okay? I'm not... That's just what happens. But I'm a big Robert Eggers guy. I remember when we saw The Lighthouse in theaters. Do you remember that? And it was the premiere of Last Christmas, and we were like waiting in line to get popcorn, and Emilia Clarke and Emma Thompson just like walked by us and waved, and I was like, oh,
yeah,
hey, Mother
and
of
we
Dragons.
Saw Paul. We saw Paul Feig in his suit and everything.
Oh,
meanwhile,
that's right.
I remember that, like, we were walking up to see The Lighthouse. It was in, like, AMC somewhere in New York City.
The Lincoln Center.
Lincoln Center one. And, you know, the premiere's going on. And we're going to see The Lighthouse, like, you know, like, kind of like a fucked up horror movie. And they have, like, these carolers out for Last Christmas, the random rom-com that nobody remembered six years later. And I remember the carolers were just like saying, like, "Last Christmas, I gave you my heart," while like we're passing by, and we're like, "Okay."
Yeah, it was a little definitely tonally different.
So you consider yourself an Eggers fan, though?
Yeah,
overall.
I've seen all of his work.
I've seen all of his work. I am overall just he is not connected with me. I mean, I think that I could say this: I've seen all four of his movies, and I say that I probably fall asleep during all of them, briefly.
Do you fall asleep during Nosferatu? Like, I feel like this would be I feel like this would be right up your alley, dude.
I didn't hate this movie, but I didn't love it either. I thought it was okay.
I didn't love this one either. I thought it was really good. I thought it was a good movie.
I thought it was okay. My problem with Eggers in general is just overall pacing. I feel like a lot of his movies aren't paced that well for me. I feel like they kind of drag and drag. I mean, The Witch especially. Grant, I need to rewatch The Witch.
I feel like one of the beautiful things about this podcast, Tommy, and just like having done this for, oh, you know, what is it?
Going on
3 years now, is that you and I feel like are starting to have, like, we start to have more appreciation for films and being able to discuss them that maybe we wouldn't have had before, where we would have just watched it once and completely dismissed it.
Like, I'll say this, like, The Lighthouse, when we first saw it in theaters, I remember being like, yeah, that's all right, I guess. And then I end up rewatching it about like a year ago or a year and a half ago for our buddies, the Film Versus Film podcast. I forget what exactly we were covering, but one of the movies we covered was The Lighthouse. And I rewatched it, and on rewatch, I was like, fuck, this movie rocks. This movie is great. This movie is fucking awesome. So I feel like he's a movie director that I feel like I need to sieve his movies a little bit more. He's a little more dense than other filmmakers
He's
out there.
dense. So I don't think pacing has really ever been the problem. Like, his movies are like average runtime are like 2 hours. It's not like these movies are, it's not like he's putting out 3.5 hour epics
No,
time
no,
after
no,
time again.
but pacing is not just runtime. Pacing is
I no
also just how a scene breathes and everything. And
I know, believe me, I know. I'm saying I think the big thing that can make it feel less paced is his, he likes to use as authentic a dialect as he can. Like that, if you're going to show someone The Witch, the first thing you have to tell them is like they're going to speak like 1600s Victorian style English, okay? Like they
yeah.
are not, like
Let me
you
say this
have
about
to
The
get
Witch,
to,
my
you have
viewing
to.
circumstances. I watched it with my mom and my aunt, and we expected a scary movie, and we were like,
Well, it is a scary movie.
we didn't find it scary. We were like, what the fuck is this? This is boring
Well, that's when you
shit.
have somebody being like, oh, this is boring. I feel like now if you watched it like
If I
under the
watched it by
rights of.
myself, I'd probably appreciate it a little bit more. But I think you and I saw it in theaters. I fell asleep during that, I remember.
You always
And
fall asleep during movies though, so I don't even know how to judge you on
yeah,
that.
like, is that that much of a criticism? Sometimes it's not, but I feel like in that case, I just did not connect to that movie either. I thought I was like, it's fine. I just think that it's just the just basic like dourness of his movies and stuff, which sometimes can fit for the material. I think from Nosferatu, it did fit for the material.
For all
But
of his movies, it's fit.
yeah, but I'm saying that sometimes it's just a slog to get through that type of pacing
I
or
don't think it's a
style.
slog to get through it. I think there can be a mental barrier before putting it on, being like, I'm gonna have to, like, you know how there's sometimes movies you can just put on and you just know it's like, okay, whatever. This is one of those movies that, like, when you put on a Robert Eggers movie, you kind of know you need to invest 100% of your time into it.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I can watch Scream all day and be fine, and like that's a fun movie and like fun pulpy movie, but I have to like prepare to watch a Robert Eggers movie. I need to like make sure I'm like a distraction-free environment. Like I've ever since we started this podcast, I've become less and less of a phone face, where like I put my phone away,
Yeah.
and like when I'm watching a movie, I'm like okay, like get locked in. And for Eggers, sometimes it's just a little more daunting to do that with him.
Yeah, it's just more, it's more of a like, I don't know if I'm gonna love something set in the Industrial Revolution time period in Germany, like Nosferatu.
Yeah, but
But
to go back to the movie itself of Nosferatu, I mean, I think that his basic sense of like gothicness really fits the material really
oh
well. I mean,
yeah.
I think the production value, the cinematography of this movie is just
Stunning.
incredible. Yeah, it's easily the best part of this movie for me. And I just think that like the shots of like Nicholas Holt's character, what Thomas Hutter, I think his name is, just going to the castle, and you just see the like
Yeah.
overshot of the castle. Just what a fucking amazing like set design right there.
Oh yeah. Like the set design was great. I loved like going back to the original Nosferatu, the shot of him approaching the castle, getting dropped off by the carriages, walking, and then having Nosferatu himself pick him up versus in this one, like a goat in the new one, a ghost carriage picks him up and drives him
Yeah.
off. I really felt like the voice of Nosferatu, like the sound, vital to the like this movie's success. Like the sound design and the production design around Nosferatu itself, he is just so eerie. Like I was so like creeped out by him.
Oh yeah, I mean the voice itself. I think we should probably make a distinction between which one we're talking about, because we're going to go back and
We're
forth a little
just gonna
bit.
we'll do the
So
Eggers and the original.
yeah, Eggers in the original. Yeah, I think that's a good way of it. So when we're talking about Eggers, yeah, there you go. So I think the overall sound, I tried to do an impression of it, and granted, it's been like a couple months since I've seen the movie, and I did not test the voice before I tried it for the intro, and it was just like, I was like, how do you do it? It's like a fucking like throat thing, where it's like, oh, you won't see me, and like I
It's
could
like an
not do it.
ancient, it's like the throat chanting in
And
Dune.
very throat chanting, very like Romanian too, like thick Romanian accent too. Just what a way. I mean, yeah, when we covered Bela Lugosi Dracula, I feel like that's one that lets the voice of Bela Lugosi has been so parodied to death that that just lost all its thunder for us.
Yeah, and I think the movie itself just not being very good, like kind of lost some of the thunder for us as well in that. In that movie. You're muted, Tommy.
If you look back, we were haters on that movie,
Oh, we
on
were.
that
I think we
episode.
gave that like, I think I gave it like a star, and I was
Yeah,
like,
I
it's
gave it
only
like
getting a
two and a
star
half.
for, I think I gave it a star for like, and it was just a legacy star. I could not tell you how many times I hit the remote on that button, just being like, all right, how much time is left? It's still 30 minutes left. I swear I looked 10 minutes ago and there was 30 minutes left. It was one of
Yeah.
those, it was one of those movies where.
So, but yeah, like to, basically, like the way of like, vampires in general have been so over-parodied. So, like, then we had the boom of like Twilight and like even Interview with the Vampire, where like vampires are sexy now. So, basically, Eggers, the way he designed Nosferatu and what he wanted Nosferatu to be was like, I want people to understand this is a corpse. This is like revolting.
And
And
he's horny as shit.
yeah, he's horny as shit. And yet somehow some people on Twitter still were horny about fucking Skarsgård in this movie. Where,
I mean,
yeah.
it was a terrific performance. And I mean, Lily Rose Depp also with a just a terrific performance there. What did you
Breakout
think?
role.
What did you think about Aaron Taylor Johnson?
I thought he was fine. I
I
thought he
thought he
was
was
totally
fine
fine.
too. I thought people were over exaggerating because a lot of people had a lot of issues with Aaron Taylor Johnson,
I
but I
don't know
thought he
what there
kind
is to
of.
hate about him in that
I didn't
movie.
either. I'm like watching and I'm like, what am I supposed to like you could definitely learn to dislike the character. He was kind of put in there. Like the character is there as an opposition to the good guys because he's the one with all the funding and all this, and he won't help with this plague coming in, and he's sick of having Lily Rose Depp's character around and freaking out his wife and his children, right? But like that's just the character itself. Like the criticisms were heavily pointed at his performance, and I'm not saying he's an Academy, it's an Academy Award winning performance, but it was good. It was solid. It
Yeah,
was
it was
serviceable.
solid. It was what it done. But like Lily Rose Depp in general, though she was the breakout star of this. I mean, she's been in a few other things before. I think I mentioned the movie Silent Night that she was in, which is like a fun movie where it's basically like Christmas and it turns out it's the end of the world and people celebrating the holiday to like cope with the fact the world's ending. But she, before this, she was mostly known for like, what was that movie that, show that came out? The Idol that came out 2 years
Yes,
ago.
yeah.
There's that, and like people trash that. People are like, oh, this is shit. And she was also known for fucking Yoga Hosers. Speaking of Kevin Smith, his worst movie ever. I still haven't seen it because I've heard it's just god awful. So the fact that she came back and like, after like pretty much just known for shit for the most part and
Yeah.
delivered a performance like this, like what a fucking way. The scene of her like convulsing and just like freaking out and then telling Nicholas Holt, Hutter, you'll never please me like he did. Just fucking chilling. Just the
Yeah.
way that went out. It was just like,
And then
what?
he goes in as hard as he possibly can. As I could say, this movie was very horny without being like overly like sexual or objectifying. I find it was
It wasn't a Verhoeven movie.
no, it wasn't American Pie movie. It wasn't a Verhoeven movie. There's some nudity in it, but it's not nothing. I wouldn't say it's like a sexy movie, but it is a horny movie, and there is a distinction between the two.
Oh, totally. Because it's all about the desire and stuff like that. Of like, oh, like, I think the best adaptations of Dracula will go into like the I have crossed like seas and like time to come see you, for like Lily Rose Depp type of character.
Yes.
So within that.
Yeah. So then let's kind of contrast it back to the original
Yeah.
Nosferatu, the
So.
1922 film. Tommy,
Oh,
you.
I didn't know if you, I thought you were about to play something for a second.
No, I don't have anything. Well, I have something, but not. I'm waiting for you to cue it up.
So anyways, so Nosferatu, first of all, original. How many silent movies have you seen before?
I've seen a couple of Chaplins, a couple of Buster Keatons.
Yeah. This might be other than like movies that like have since like have like zero dialogue or something like that, like more modern ones. I think this might be the only silent movie I've seen. So, I mean, that's definitely like Chaplin and Buster Keaton's role or something we could definitely go back to in the future. But just, I feel like the silent movie and like the way the film stock has aged, with most of like the adaptations you see of this or most of the restorations you see of this kind of adds to the horror of this movie. I feel like this is just a very unsettling movie when you watch it. And, sometimes I talk about how like when we watch older movies, how like it's kind of eerie to me that like almost everyone's dead. But all right, in this case, every single person's dead. Some of these people died before my grandparents were fucking born. That's how old a movie we're talking about. I feel like that adds to the creepiness of this, where it feels like you're watching like a movie that they would find in the basement in Evil Dead or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yes, definitely. So Max Schreck played Graf Orlok in this one. It's the very iconic look where he's almost like mousy looking with like two like needles as teeth there, and just like these claws and this hunchback. If you grew up watching SpongeBob, you've definitely seen Nosferatu. There's a couple episodes where they make references. I would say for most of our generation, we first heard of Nosferatu through SpongeBob.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, exactly. And I feel like it's just a general, like, there's three or four very iconic shots in this movie that, like, stand the test of time. One's the one of him, like, arriving in, like, the door frame, where you just see him in the door frame. The other one is the one where he's walking up the stairs, so you see his shadow, just a
It's the
silhouette.
shadow. So yeah.
Yeah. And the other is the end of the movie when he goes to bite
Ellen.
Ellen, and he's just looking up. And that's the shot. I think they took that shot in SpongeBob
And then
at
there's also the one of Ellen where she's like putting her hand on her forehead, like right at the end there, like, oh,
one
like
point.
that. I
But
think.
I think what gets to this with movie with me is going back to a point I made on our Dracula episode. That this is a tweet I saw that this the invention of sound set back the visual language of movies by like at least 10 or 20 years. Because you see this movie compared to what we saw in Dracula, and it's night and day just how different the cinematography is.
Dracula is so flat, so uninteresting visually to look at. Because I mean, back at the time, like they would have symphonies in the, or at least just a piano in the theater playing the scores. And that leads to some confusion because Tommy and I had a bit of a conversation about which versions should we watch, because there's a lot of different versions of this and there's a lot of different scores, and obviously scores are going to make a difference when it comes to the movie you're actually watching.
Exactly. So, what we did for this episode was I went down like a rabbit hole. I first of all rented the video from Best Video. Shout out to them. And the Best Video DVD was from Kino Video, Kino Lobar, I think is what they're called now. And they had two different scores on them, and both of them were really solid. And then, so I took 30-second clips from the end of the movie when he's walking up the stairs, from the two different scores I had on that DVD, and then one from the version you could find on Amazon Prime right now, which is a fully colored restoration, which I think if you're doing a fully colored restoration for a black and white movie, like fuck that. No, you don't need to, you can make it
Well,
colored.
it's a public domain thing, right? Like that's why they do it. Just because it's like it's different and it's public domain and we can do what we want, and then there's no like it's a different version of it, so copyright holders don't have to get
It's
into
like
it.
the
And
It's a Wonderful Life thing where they
yeah.
cut out the whole
Oh, don't
Potterstown thing.
we already went into that enough. Please, please, please. Sickening. But this is the version that was found on Amazon Prime first. This is the Art Zoid score. This is the version I also watched. And then this is the Donald Sosin score. Thank you. So it's very interesting to me because this is all the iconic shot of Nosferatu climbing the stairs, hunchback, and it's just the shadow of him moving up and up. It's a very iconic shot in film history. You've probably seen it at one point or another. It's been around for over 100 years, but it's
It's
so
been in a
intricate.
lot of movies.
And it's been in a lot of movies, a lot of TV shows, parodied to death, yada, yada, yada. It is so interesting to me, like hearing these three scores back to back to back, and how different a feeling all three of them evoke.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the Amazon Prime one almost feels whimsical in a way.
Yeah,
It doesn't feel scary. Like it feels like, oh, like just like, oh,
it was
just
a
like.
much faster tempo than the other two. It used different percussion as well to like give it that, like it was like using a xylophone.
Yeah, exactly. It was just like, why would you put this in like a scene that should be really scary? There's something interesting about Nosferatu when you look up the running time, is that it'll say like it can run from anywhere from like 63 to 94 minutes, depending on transfer speed.
Yeah.
So the Amazon Prime one is cl clearly sped up a little bit, which I could tell too when I was going back and forth between the three. But still, just almost whimsical. Like you can't really feel the horror. I feel like the Art Zoid, or what is his name? Art
Art
Zoid.
Zoid, that's what I have it at.
Yeah. That one was terrifying at parts. And that one, like, I feel like really sold the horror in a way for me. And like it felt a little more modern. It felt more like kind of like
It
a
definitely felt more contemporary.
yeah.
Definitely borrowed from like Italian slashers.
Yeah, Italian giallos, like Suspiria and shit like that. I got that vibe. And then the last one I felt like was still a little scary, but kind of felt a little more
It
closer
felt
to like
minimalist.
yeah, exactly. Except one part where it's just like ba-da-da-da.
Yeah, and but I think it's important for us to kind of note this because if you, the listener, are like, I'd be interested in watching this piece of film history, there's a lot of different versions for you to go through, and your experience with this movie is going to directly relate to the score that you watch.
Exactly. And there's so many different ones that we didn't even cover that we couldn't even find. Like apparently like James Bernard, who scored Hammer horror films in the 1950s and 60s, did a version. The doom metal band Typo Negative did a version that was on a VHS copy of this. So like just the different contrasting. I mean, I personally prefer the Art Zoid one because I felt like even in the moments where like Nosferatu was there just felt just like felt like a dread throughout
There's
it.
an ominous feeling towards that score. I felt like at points in that score when it wasn't focused on Nosferatu, specifically in the beginning, like when he goes to the Gypsy Tavern, slightly different than the Robert Eggers version, that Gypsy Tavern scene, but still there where he's like, oh, I need to go to Count Olark's, and everybody goes, oh, how dare you go up there? You never go up there. Like that score never really found that tone, but whenever Nosferatu was on it, the score definitely matched it, and that's when it's the most important. But
Yeah.
it kind of there's definitely points where it just felt like this is a job I'm getting paid for. We're just gonna stilt this together here just to kind of keep the show going.
Yeah, I want to shout out some guy we interact with on Twitter, Sean Foss. I posted a clip of the Art Zoid score, and he's said that he actually knows what the reason why that score exists. It happened in like the mid to late 90s, and basically the guy who was in charge of the colorization of the print wanted a new score that had like a Tangerine Dream kind of vibe, which is like an 80s like
Yeah.
kind of experimental band, and you can feel it. I mean, especially in one points where like it's just Thomas Hutter and I always forget her name, fucking
Ellen.
Ellen, just talking, where it's just like the overall like it feels like you're in a fairy tale and a dream or something like that, and very creepy and very unsettling throughout it.
Yes,
So,
definitely.
but it's the
Get
crazy thing about this movie is that like apparently the original score of this movie is just like not saved.
lost
Lost.
to time.
Yeah, some pieces are still there, but overall it's lost. So like you have to wonder what it was like in 1922. Like what was the specific score? I mean, I feel like most people would have just been like a piano player or something like that, because that's the stereotype we think of sound films of that era. Just like just the guy with sheet music playing something while something just casually was on the screen.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm
But
try I was trying to find in my research too, is like when did, because this was a German film, and like when did it start to grab hold in the United States? Because it seems like it's one of those things where it's like, especially the way film was preserved at the time, there's not necessarily a chance it would have been distributed here.
Yeah, I mean, apparently they like had trouble finding like a print that was like the original subtitles and stuff like that. There's a 1930s sound version that they did, which was like a completely unauthorized and re-edited version of the film. What's crazy is that the director, F.R., how do you say his name? Murano, he died in like 1931 at the age of like 42 in a car accident. So how quickly the film just got away from him in that aspect. So I feel like by the time this went to US, it probably was maybe what's it called, like sanitized a little bit. And
Yeah,
yeah.
definitely. Definitely, especially with the way the studio systems work, it's more about how they felt it, directors didn't really have visions back there, and very rare that they did. And most movies were producers' movies, like Gone with the Wind, the biggest movie of that time, of that golden age of Hollywood, right? That's a David O. Selznick picture. Like, Victor Fleming was the director on the movie, but it's a David O. Selznick picture. Like, that was
Yeah.
his movie. And like, the producer just had a lot more standing and a lot more clout than the director themselves did.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a little different in Germany at the time. I mean, Murnau, they on the DVD had a couple of like clips from some of his other sound films, and you can definitely see like a consistent vision throughout the different films. Even these like brief like 2 to 3 minute clips of just like eeriness and just like overall like
Unsettlingness.
unsettling this emphasis on just like great creepy cinematography. I mean, there's one shot in this movie that like I feel like if you're watching a certain score of it would be completely goofy, but in the Artzoid score was, I mean, completely like humorous. And the Artzoid score was completely creepy, and it's the part where Nosferatu is just like carrying around his coffin. And it's completely campy in a way, just the
Yeah, oh
visual of it
yeah.
itself. Of him just like, if you see like a screen grab of it, it's him just like almost doing a double take, and he's like looking both ways before he crosses the road, and just like this guy in this fucking like weird ass like makeup. But like then the fact that the way the cinematography goes for like you just see him levitate the coffins, which I don't know how they did that back in 1922. But
Crafty
regard
editing and crafty special effects, man. That's
yeah.
how you would do it. But it's just goes to show, like, I think the beautiful thing of film is, like, you can see it almost as like a snowball, and you can see the language of it. And then especially when you start going out to international, like, whereas like a movie from 1922 produced in Hollywood probably doesn't have the same cinematic quality that they did, because you had A Birth of a Nation, W.D. Du Bois film, and then he had, what was that colossal fuck up he had afterward? It bombed afterward, and like, I feel like Hollywood kind of got away from grandiose for a little bit there and were more focused on like turning profits on cheap, easy films to film Nickelodeons. It was to fill that out. It had nothing else to do with it. And then it was once MGM was founded. MGM was kind of seen as a leader at the time, and then the original 1924 Ben-Hur, which had like an astounding like $2 million budget at that time, and they shot in Italy, and it had to be reshot, and like that whole studio's future was based on the success of that. And that was one of where maybe the more conventional way we view films starts in Hollywood itself, but at this time, this is something that would be seen as very influential and
This movie basically
groundbreaking.
like set the template for like the modern horror movie. I mean, you can see just like how influential this is even to this day, where like obviously, there's a remake we just were talking about earlier, and that's clearly reverential to that. But like, even just like your typical horror filmmaker and how much it makes a difference in how much the cinematography and the shots and just the overall vibe. I feel like the film stock just adds to this vibe of it, where it feels like you're about to watch the film blow up,
Yeah, it
like
does.
go on fire.
And it has this like orange hue to it, and it's
Yeah.
like there's times where it was like kind of like light blue, and then like the text comes up and Nosferatu's like, "Oh, will you stay up with," like when Hutter first gets to the castle, he's like, "Will you stay up with me? I can only stay awake at night, not during the days." And like, I'm like looking at the film and I'm like, "It looks like day in there, man. What are you talking about?" So
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
very
That's the one thing I couldn't tell. Like, I mean, that's one thing. Like, I couldn't tell sometimes when it was supposed to be nighttime, which was funny. But one thing I hated about the Amazon Prime thing with the brief, like, 30-second clip I shared earlier was it definitely felt like the title cards were like a modern edition, where like it
Oh, I'm
was just
sure.
like, cut in, where it was just like clearly like someone on Photoshop or something like that, like typing in an old timey font, where it didn't feel like this, where it was just like bursting at the seams right here. And I don't know if your cut had this, but I liked how the film stock kind of changed color, where it went from like
Oh, yeah.
orange to green to blue and from different
Oh,
shots,
definitely.
which definitely added to the old timey nature of this, where like I was thinking about how Tarantino was mentioning recently. I saw some quote that was like, film, when you shoot on film, like 35 millimeter or whatever, you're creating the illusion of movement because you're basically stitching together these different frames from
Yeah.
piece to piece to piece. And I definitely felt that within this movie, where it, like, the shot I was talking about earlier, where like the coffins are levitating, it felt like it was almost just like still photographs are just
It was.
attached together. And it was, I mean,
That's what it
but
was.
yeah, but it feels just so eerie in that way. In a way, you don't really feel it with more modern movies. I mean, I've seen so many movies on 35 millimeter before, and the 90s movies I've seen, like Speed or The Thing on 35 millimeter, don't obviously have that factor to it or vibe.
Well, there was a great video I saw on YouTube recently. I do not remember this creator's name. I apologize, but look up roughly the title is about like modern cinematography and what happened. And the movie he used to contrast, because like remember Wicked and the cinematography in that, and it just looks so like unalive, so uninteresting. There's no shadows, there's no bright colors. It's just like this gray muted tone because it's using so many green screens and special effects, but they're not just like, yeah, we're not gonna light this. Who cares? The audience doesn't care, so who cares? And then you contrast it to a movie like The Parent Trap, the Lindsay Lohan Parent Trap from the 90s, the Nancy Meyers film. And like, I haven't seen that since I was a kid, but I did not realize like how well shot that movie is and like how gorgeous the cinematography is in a movie like that. And when you think of something like The Parent Trap, oh, funny enough, the guy who lit The Thing was the one who lit The Parent Trap. But that's the funny thing is like that's the language of film itself is the shadows, the lighting, like what else are, the dialogue moves the story along, but what is the film telling you that you can pick up on the cues? Like I say I like less is more in my scripts. Like I don't need you to beat me over the head telling me how to feel and what the characters are feeling and saying it. Show me it. Show me it through lighting. Show me it through emotion, through characters, through coming, in the shadow, like make it come alive.
Yeah, it's one of those things that like as I've been more and more collecting physical media in 4K, and ever since I got like a PS5, when like collecting like 4Ks for an older movie, like even like a 90s movie or something like that, like your general run-of-the-mill like trash like horror movie or something like that, like how great it looks just from 4K standpoint, whereas like the modern equivalent of it just looks flat and it's just straight. I feel like modern cinematography is just not there in a way it used to be. And even this of Nosferatu in 1922, just how much even just like the film stock that feels like it's barely even there.
It feels like it's clinging to life.
Yeah, exactly. But it's still just how great that feels and how much that adds to a vibe of this movie, where like I feel like the better, less dialogue sometimes is sometimes the better.
And listen, in modern film, there is great cinematography. Like, I think of
The
Barbie
movie we were
last.
just talking about.
Well, I Nosferatu for one, but think of something like Barbie, and like how that movie uses color. Barbie wasn't great, but it was a fun movie. I wasn't the target audience for it. That's fine. But it was a fun movie, like so bright and lively and full of color. Like, how could you not like that? And then I think of something like Wicked, and I felt like this movie could have been so great if it was shot like a movie. But there
Or like
are
Deadpool
contemporary.
Wolverine, where it has a wa washed out
It's just this washed out filler color, like didn't.
desaturation.
Yeah, just didn't even give it a thought. But you have like The Brutalist, for example, like that should probably win best cinematography at the Oscars, in my opinion. Gorgeous, gorgeous movie. Really terrific use of lighting in that movie. And I just, I don't want to say that it doesn't exist, but in our bigger overarching landscape of film and like when it's not a priority by the studio or the filmmaker, they clearly don't care about it.
Exactly. And plus, like, I've heard, like, I was actually looking at a thread about this about Wicked specifically, where, like, apparently, like, the way they shot it was to make it easier to add in, like, last minute VFX changes.
Of course it
So,
was.
yeah. So.
And I think for something that's like a musical adaptation, like the less VFX and the more like Real practical dancing on real sets is like what I would want, what I wanted out of it, which you kind of got. But all right, let's move on here and let's talk about the performances.
I am a star. I'm a star, I'm a star, I'm a star. I am a big, bright, shining star.
All right, let's quickly touch on Robert Eggers' 2024 Nosferatu in terms of the performances. I think we'll have a little bit more to discuss when it comes to the 1922 one, just because we're not experts in silent films by any chance. So, and it's just a different type of performance. So for the Eggers version, who did you feel gave the best performance?
Seen like two other versions of the story at this point, and we talked about other versions of this and of like Ellen, and I forget what she's called in the Dracula version, but it's just like a star-making performance right here. I would not be shocked for her to break out even more from this. She really just sells like the overall possession that she feels, and like the sickness of it, and just like the weird desire that she feels and the repression that she feels from the time. It's an amazing performance.
Yeah, I agree, and I felt like too. What was interesting about it, because I went in hearing like, oh, she gives a great performance. Like the first 45 minutes, it's very reserved, and it's kind of brilliant in that way because once she starts to unravel, like the beauty of it comes in because it shows us who she was beforehand, and then we see the descent and the connection that she has with Count Orlok. I also do want to shout out Bill Skarsgård. Like man, like if Count Orlok does not work, this movie does not work, and he pulls it off flawlessly, effortlessly, even
This
really
is a
and it's a
movie.
really technical performance too, the way he uses his throat. Like you can really feel that in the performance. It's so unsettling, it's so creepy in a way that like was not physically possible in the 1922 version.
Oh, not at all. But this is a movie like I would love to revisit on my like home theater system and like crank up the subwoofer and just feel, because I feel like my like apartment would shake whenever Nosferatu speaks, because just a booming bass-filled voice.
Hollowing voice.
I want to shout out, because we talked about him a lot during American Psycho when I discussed it earlier, but we did not talk about him for Nosferatu. Willem Dafoe, wonderfully gleefully campy performance. He's definitely like Eggers' muse. I think he's been in
Oh, he's been
all but one of his movies at this point.
all but the witch.
All but The Witch, and just like what a fun like take on like Van Helsing, essentially. Of
Yeah.
just like this maniacally crazy guy. He was just such a fun fucking like weirdo
As
in
ever had, yeah, he was a very fun alchemist professor. And Nicholas Hoult was also great as like your straight man in this too. He's having himself a hell of a year, man. He's really
He's
blowing
on a
up.
heater.
He's on a heater right now, but that was another really fun performance as well. But you go Lily Rose Depp, I'll go Bill Skarsgård because those are the two standouts easily. Now onto the 1922 Nosferatu. You have Max Schreck as Graf Olaf. You have Gustav von Wagenheim as Hutter. You have Greta Schroeder as Ellen. You have Alexander Granach as Nock and Hausmacher, and you have Gustav Boltz as Professor Sievers de Stadtarts, and John Gotthwaite as Professor Bulwer. An amount of that, if we're going to be honest here. But what performance struck you the most in this movie?
I think it's very obvious. Count Orlok himself, Max Schreck. I mean, there's a whole movie, speaking of Defoe again, I don't know if you ever heard of, called Shadow of the Vampire, which is like a 2000 movie, which was basically the premises Nosferatu, what if Max Schreck was actually a vampire? And Max Schreck is played by Willem Dafoe in that movie. And it is a very like unsettling performance. I was a rumor for years that like they actually just found this demon, to the point that like you could see it, and it feels like you're almost watching like evil itself in this movie, especially if you're watching like the correct score for that, I feel like.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, Max Schreck is the easy answer. It's such an iconic performance. I did love Gustav von Wagenheim as Hutter. I really thought he gave like a really great and vibrant performance from like a straight facial features and facial von Wagenheim as well. But
Yeah, he was good. And I mean, Greg Schroeder, I mean, it's interesting talking about like the performances, like where we talk about like how we talk about the different voices and everything like that with the original, whereas this one is just like the look and the physicality. That's why Max Schreck was one for me. But Greg Schroeder, I feel like just that final scene, because I watched it like 3 times in the last hour, just how great her physicality is, of just like just her panic when she sees Nosferatu through the window. I mean, like, I feel like you really had to sell the physicality way much more back then, obviously, because you couldn't use your voice. I
Oh,
feel like the
yeah.
limitation also enabled more creativity back then, in a
Of
way.
course. Of course. Limitation breeds creativity. And yeah, that's what happens when you don't, when you have lazy people using CGI. But anyway, Muppet time.
Ah, are you ready, comedy partner? Waka waka.
Tommy, would Nosferatu, just in general, I don't think we need to make a distinguish between the two of them because they kind of are telling the same story. But wouldn't you kind of, I feel like the Muppets, in terms of like a silent movie, a silent horror film, could sell that physicality in a very comedic way.
Oh, 100%. I mean, the fact that our generation knows who Nosferatu is mostly because of SpongeBob, is just like shows that like, you can definitely have that character in a more like family friendly kind of way. And there's obviously the Count. The Count would obviously be Max Schreck. That's the most obvious
Yes.
one. In that image I just showed you.
Hutter would be Kermit.
Yeah.
Then Ellen would be Piggy, obviously. And then you could just pick and choose who you want from there. There's definitely something to it. I feel like the Muppet team could have like a lot of fun and a lot of breathe a lot of creativity into like putting the puppets and using shadows and different lightings and stuff to kind of create a slapstick horror.
Yeah, like a better version of Dracula Dan loving
Yes. Yes, essentially.
it.
All right, Tommy, review time. Give me your score out of 5 for both of them. Just start with whichever one you want to start with and end
All
with
right,
one. Just make.
the Eggers version first. So it was a movie that I felt like overall great performances in there, amazing cinematography. I just felt like my main problem with it was a little bit of pacing, where I felt like it kind of slogged at some points. I feel like there's an overall issue I have with Eggers in general. And I'm curious to see how it holds up on rewatch. But I felt at some points a little bit checked out, even though I loved Skarsgård's design, his voice, and even Lou Rose Depp, I feel like is definitely going to be getting more and more roles to come from this. I'm going to go 3.5 out of 5 for that one. And for the original, I think this is an incredible piece of cinema. I mean, the fact this has stood the test of time, the fact that this survived a copyright infringement where they were ordered to destroy every single print, and we can still see this movie 100 years later. It feels like you're watching a cursed tape, especially with the score, the Artzoid score, which I felt was really eerie, really creepy, and just terrifying when I was watching this last night by myself. So the cinematography still holds up. I mean, like overall, the stock is just great creepiness. I'm gonna have to go, I don't say, I think 5 out of 5. This is a classic for a reason.
Interesting, very interesting. For me, the Eggers version, I'm gonna go 3.5 out of 5. I think you're right. It's just for Eggers and for like his style, which is what I really love. Like it definitely comes through here. It's very apparent. It's not like Sam Raimi when he did that Doctor Strange movie, and it felt like they nerfed like what makes a Sam Raimi movie a Sam Raimi movie. This felt very much like a Robert Eggers movie, but it felt like it was on railroad tracks and obviously by design, but I like when it's something like The Lighthouse and he could just go weird with it and just kind of explore the characters themselves, where this is like a very linear plot structure. For me, on the original Nosferatu, I'm going to give it a 4 to 5. Really influential piece of filmmaking, actually holds up to watching today, which is a big part of that score for me. I think you could give it a 5 out of 5 if you'd like. I just don't think it's there for me personally. Maybe it's just the genre. Like maybe it's because I've been in the past 4 months that it doesn't hit the same way. You know, I saw this one after the Robert Eggers version, so I kind of knew what was coming, and I kept kind of just relating back to the Robert Eggers version of it versus like maybe taking it on its own merit. But truly a triumphant film, definitely something very memorable, very deserved of its reputation. And if you're interested in learning about the history of film and silent film, it's definitely a great place to start. All right, Tommy, any final thoughts before we wrap up this episode?
Well, thank you guys so much for listening. You can follow us on social media. That's at CNetPod. That's on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, the occasional thread, and we're on Blue Sky also at podcnet.bluesky.social. So follow us there too, and leave us a 5-star review, Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. And next week, we're going from covering a silent movie to a movie that's nothing but talking. We're covering Before Sunrise, that
I'm
deeply
very
wrote.
ex very excited for Before Sunrise.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie. I watched it for the first time a couple months ago, and I was like, we need to watch this. And it just celebrated its 30th anniversary very recently. So get ready for that. And yeah, thank you guys for listening.
Thank you guys so much for listening. We will see you next time.